Vayikra, Parsha Nine Gimel, says the following. Everybody knows the first pasuk in the Parsha with Vayikra, Moshe Vayikra, Parsha Nine Gimel, Moed Lamor, right? Vayikra is written with a small aleph over here. So the real line is that it should say the word Vayikor. And Moshe Rabbeinu put in the aleph and made it small, but it really should have been big because the Kodesh Baruch wanted to say Vayikra. So Rashi says, the whole tibur, the whole mirror, the whole tibur, we cut the kriya. Every time HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to speak to Moshe Rabbeinu, there was first a kriya. As by the Malachim, there's a type of lashon that they use, the Karozel of Yamar, that they all speak to each other and say Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. But by the prophets of the world, he speaks them in the lashon of Arai, in a temporary lashon and a type of tuma type of lashon. So it's the word Vayikor. As if it's not so special, if it's just some tiny little thing, instead of the word Vayikra. That's the idea behind it. And that's the difference between Bilam, who God spoke to only temporarily and only in a little bit, and Vayikra, which is HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaking to Moshe Rabbeinu in a way that he really wanted to speak to him. What's the pshat? Why did Moshe Rabbeinu want to write the word Vayikor? So we probably have about 25 answers. About 13 of them we gave last year and the year before that as to why we're going to have it. But I saw another Chassam Sofer this year, and you have to say, whenever you get a Chassam Sofer that's going to say something like this, you got to go ahead. Person goes in to meet the king, but he's not so cautious. So he sends his message into the palace, and the king knows he needs to speak to him. Okay, he knows, but the problem is he doesn't want to let him into the inner chambers, because if he brings him into the inner chambers, that means he's giving him a little bit of chashivus that this guy doesn't deserve. This guy should not be in the inner chambers with the queen and the king. He doesn't deserve to be in the inner chambers with the king. So therefore, the king goes out to meet him, so it's not as chashivus. You think, oh, the king's going out to meet him, such an unbelievable thing. Well, it's because the king does need to speak to him at that moment, but really this is the least chashiv way of doing so. Pulling him, going out to him, rather than letting the man come to you in your private chambers. That's Vayikor. God goes out to speak to the other nations of the world that they need to be spoken to, because he doesn't want them coming close. He doesn't need them. He doesn't want to be anywhere near them. But he realizes they need a bone, they need something that he can give them, so he goes out to them and speaks to them. That's the word Vayikor, getting around there. But if you're chashiv, then the king will go, not even bother going out to speak to you. He'll call you into his inner chambers, the place where he sits and he relaxes, and you get to go in and you get to talk to the king in the most private manner as possible. Nobody else around, just you and the king, and that's that. Now even then, there's two types of people that get to go into the private chambers of the king. One of them is like a worker. Now a worker will go into the king's palace, into the king's room, and it could even be he gets to touch the king. If he's a clothing maker for the king, or if he's cutting the hair of the king, or he's giving him a beard cut or anything like that, that he can go ahead, a worker can get all the way in and touch the king, go all the way inside. But an advisor can only go so far. He's allowed to speak to the king, he's allowed to give him advice, but he can't come so close. It would be weird if the advisor goes ahead and starts touching the king's head while he's telling him, I think it's time to destroy the other kingdom. That's strange. Nobody usually does such a thing, and if they do, that really has to stop. But everyone would agree that the advisor is much better than the worker. Nobody's going to say that the guy who's making the clothes for the king is more chashuv than the guy who's giving advice to the king. Everybody's going to agree that the advisor is so much greater. So what's the pshat? What's the difference over here? The difference that we're trying to say, that there's a worker and then there's an advisor. See, there's Aaron HaKohen. Aaron HaKohen is an unbelievably chashuv person. He gets to go into the inner chambers of the king, into the Kodesh HaKadoshim on Yom Kippur, as the Kohen Gadol, serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu, serving Klal Yisrael. That he definitely gets to do. He's unbelievably close. But that's a worker for the king. He's nothing like Moshe Rabbeinu, who HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaks to peh el peh. So even though Aaron gets to go in and even gets to go closer, gets to even touch the Kodesh HaKadoshim, while Moshe Rabbeinu is not, he stands outside and hears the voice coming to him, Mibein HaKruvim. He's not as close as Aaron in that way, but he's much greater than Aaron in the sense that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants him to be his advisor, so to speak. This is what Moshe Rabbeinu is doing. The word Vayikor is used by a person who doesn't get to go in at all. The word Vayikor is used by a person who gets to go in but is just a worker. Moshe Rabbeinu is neither. He's right in between. He's Vayikor, but he's also Vayikor. So he writes the Aleph small, and he gets to be that guy who goes in but is so chashuv. And that's the idea behind why the aleph is so small. That also explains why the ink in the aleph was used to be able to make all the shine for Moshe Rabbeinu to come out. That's also the reason why. But that's an idea behind it. Now, there's a machlokas in the Yalkut Shimon. The machlokas is whether or not God wanted the Mishkan for all of Bnei Yisrael but not for Moshe, or if he wanted it for Bnei Yisrael and for Moshe. Is it for Bnei Yisrael by themselves or Bnei Yisrael together with Moshe Rabbeinu? That's the machlokas in the Yalkut Shimon. At the very end of the day, it seems like it's both. It's for Bnei Yisrael and then it's for Bnei Yisrael together with Moshe. The Chasam Sofer, the son of the Chasam Sofer, asks and tries to figure out, what's the pshat? Why would it be for all Bnei Yisrael? Why would it be just for Moshe Rabbeinu? What's the difference between the two? Okay. We all know how Chris Farkle hates all people who have gaiva. You know that, Jordy. I mean, that's crazy, right? Anybody here done Sota Dafe? That's good. That's all of you. Great. So now that we've all done Sota Dafe, the entire daf is entirely about gaiva. How HaKadosh Baruch Hu hates it, how he despises it, how he doesn't like, he can't live together in the same world with the person who has gaiva. It's all like that. No, all of you, because I'm talking about gaiva, obviously you all have humility, right? And you're trying to be humble that you haven't done Sota, because it's the one thing that you're allowed to, three things you're allowed to lie about is Nisafta. So clearly that's the reason why you're denying it completely. So I do appreciate that, guys. Tremendous. But regardless, on Dafe and Sota, it does talk about the fact of humility. The Gemara in Sota also says that someone who is humble is as if he sacrificed all the korbanos. He did a chatas, an asham, an ola, a mincha, as well as a shlamim. All together as one. All three of them are going to be there. If you have anivus, if you knock down your gaiva, it's as if you did every single one of the korbanos. Okay. We know that the Ramban says that really, when you bring a korban, you should die for your sins. It should be you that's being sacrificed on top of the mizbeach, not anybody else. You should die for your sins, but the animal takes your place. And when you see the animal dying, it's really like you are dying. When the animal's blood is being sprinkled, it's like your blood is being sprinkled, and etc., etc. Everything that happens to the animal is as if it's happening to you. But if you're humble, then you don't need korbanos. It's only if you have gaiva that you need korbanos. And that, you need to see the animal to knock yourself down a little bit. Moshe Rabbeinu was the most humble of all people. Adam Mikaladam. Therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu, who was so humble, didn't need to bring korbanos. He didn't need to bring korbanos. It's only Bnei Yisrael that needed to bring korbanos because they had gaiva. So that's the reason why this whole parsha of korbanos, everything that we have in Vayikra, really the whole sefer, is only written for Bnei Yisrael. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't need it at all. Moshe Rabbeinu had no need to bring a korban at any point of his life because he was always humble, and a humble person does not need korbanos. Number one. We also know that a big tzaddik can be mechafer if he dies for his entire generation. Where do we learn that from? That a tzaddik that dies is mechafer for everyone else. Thank you. Very good. No, though. Not happening, says the guy who... Yeah, okay. Anyway, that is that. That's why you don't go off into work, guys. That is that, right there. What is pshat? We learn it from Parshas Chukas. Parshas Chukas starts off with the para aduma. Red heifer. Good. Red heifer. And right after he goes into the Parah Aduma, it mentions that Miriam dies. Says Rashi, why are we putting Mises Miriam by the Parah Aduma? And it says, just like the Parah Aduma is Mechaper, so to Mises Tzadikim is Mechaper. It's a big question. What does it mean that Parah Aduma is Mechaper? It's not really Mechaper. It sort of takes away tumor. That's all it does. But fine. The Gemara says that one is Mechaper, one is put next to each other, and that's the reason why. People who can't learn anything from the tzaddik while he's alive because they're amiratzim and they can't understand what the tzaddik's trying to tell them, or they can't figure out what the tzaddik is trying to do, those people, it's better for the tzaddik to die. Because then the tzaddik is an automatic kapara and everything is good for them. But for great men in Talmidei Chachamim, for men that can learn from that tzaddik, people that can be together with that tzaddik the entire time, people that can sit and learn from them all the time, it's better for the tzaddik to be alive. If the tzaddik is alive, they'll be able to do things with them, they'll be able to hear from them. Now that the tzaddik died, they can no longer learn from them. Sure, they'll get a kapara because the tzaddik died, but it's not the same. Now they can't grow even bigger, they can't be as great in the future anymore because their tzaddik, their Rebbe, just passed away. So it depends. By a Russia, it's better for the tzaddik to die. By a tzaddik, it's better for that big tzaddik to live. That's the concept of what we sit there and we say, Rebbe Yashar, please don't die, even when he's 101 years old. I mean, come on. What can we possibly do? A tzaddik can still learn from a tzaddik while he's alive. It's better for him to be alive for the good people in the world. But the Rishayim, you're right. They want somebody like that to die because they get an automatic kapara that way. That's the way that they want it to be. That's the concept of the paraduma. The paraduma is metahir, people that are tame, and metame, people that are tahor. What's pshat? If you're tame, then the paraduma's kapara is metahir you. A rasha gets a kapara through the death of a tzaddik. But if you're tahor already, you're already a big tzaddik, then you're metame, you go down a level, even though you'll get a kapara, but you're no longer going to be the same growing person. You're metame a little bit by the tzaddik dying. You're no longer going to be able to be the exact same thing. Truth is, when the Beis HaMikdash was around and the people needed a kapara, they always could have brought korbanos. Korbanos was always an option for them and it was always available to them. When the Beis HaMikdash wasn't around, then you really needed the Misa Sedikim to be machaper. Thus, Moshe Rabbeinu said to Bnei Yisrael, well, first, by the Egel, he said, said he to a Kaddish Baruch Hu, listen, if you're not going to forgive them, because they're not going to learn from me, and they're not tzaddikim to learn from the tzaddik, then kill me. And if I'm dead, then I'll cause a kapara for Klal Yisrael. HaKadosh Baruch Hu chose not to do that. Instead, he taught them Parshas the Korbanos. So Bnei Yisrael could know that when they need a kapara, you don't need the tzaddik to die. You can learn Korbanos instead. But it's unbelievable. Even though he himself didn't need to bring a korban, as we said up above, he was still an anav. He still needed this parsha, because otherwise he would have to die to be a kapara for Klal Yisrael. So Bnei Yisrael needed the parsha of Korbanos. They themselves needed it. But Moshe Rabbeinu also needed the parsha of Korbanos, because otherwise Bnei Yisrael were going to die. That was the problem, Bnei Yisrael. Moshe Rabbeinu was going to die. That's the reason why we have to understand through the Medrash that this parsha was for Moshe Rabbeinu and not for Moshe Rabbeinu at the exact same time. That's the concept.
Killing
a tzaddik is not exactly the best. No. In that case, it's more of a makashrik. It's a kitruv that caused out from there. But the death of the tzaddik, that he's now gone from the world, will allow there to be somewhat of a sanhedrin and shemayim. Just you don't want it to be through a kateger. But yes, it will cause it. If you end up, if the person dies, the person dies. To go, yeah, it did. I mean, in the end of the day, it did help them. Something went up to shemayim right after that. It is a crazy little thing. And plus, Aaron Cohen did everything that he was supposed to do because of that. Let's go through the parsha very quickly, okay? I know that this is one of, now that we're in Vayikra, everybody's bored out of their minds. Because that you sit there and you're just like, and by the time you, it's really like, because by the time you're out of yeshiva, so you get the most boring parsha as possible. Like you quit Tzav, and then you get to Shemini, and all of a sudden, Tezriah Mitzurah usually is together, so you lucked out with that. And then all of a sudden, you get back to Achramos, and like, oh, another one of you died, even though it's the second time they really died in Shemini, but people forget that because it was vacation. So you come back, and it's already by, another of you died, when it gets to Achramos, and you think Achramos, Shnei Ben Aaron, you're like, oh, here's where they died, when you're just, no, you're a fool. But that's that. And after that, you get to Achramos, Kedoshim, which talks about Arias. Everybody loves Arias, right? That's a fun thing for everyone. The Harbuk Lukos, they usually is together, so you look out with that, because even though it only talks about houses and Arachin, you're really good. But Vayikra is all Korbanos, all the way through. Starts with the Ola, and it goes afterward, all the different types of Olas that you can bring. Then it goes into the different types of Minchas that you can bring, which is always exciting, flower offerings, and every different pan that you can bring it in, like the short little pans and the deep pans. Doesn't get much better than that, pouring in frankincense, a little bit of oil, mixing it together, and then doing a little, oh, you got a little three-finger thing. And then the kamitza, everything's all good. Then all of a sudden it goes into chata, that will shlamin, and then chatos, and then asha. Okay? And those really are the five different types of korbanos. Everything that you can think of will fit into the five categories of an ola, which is entirely burnt, a mincha, which is a flower offering, then you have a shlamin, which is a peace offering, which is eaten by the owner itself, the person who brings it, as well as the kohanim themselves, they have the chos of a shok. Then you have chatos and asha, which are bought for specific sins, which are only eaten by the kohen, but not eaten by the balaam themselves. If you think of anything that you can bring, a korban tamid that you bring in the morning and the evening is type of ola. A musaf, every musaf of every yomtiv of every Shabbos, anytime you say musaf, that musaf is based, it is an ola. A korban pesach is a type of shlamin. A korban chagiga is a type of shlamin. A korban toda is a type of shlamin. There's an asham vav and an asham solo, an Asham Badai, which is given for four specific sins that are mentioned at the end of the parsha, and Asham Tali, which is given if you're Bisuffik and you're not so sure what to do. Certain animals can only be brought for one, certain animals can only be brought for the others. There are certain ones that can be voluntary, like an Ola and a Shlomin, or a Mincha even, but a Chatzas and Asham are not voluntary, it's only obligatory, it's only if you have to bring it, that's what you'd have to do. Some of them are Tzibor, they're communal, that's a good art school word for everybody for today, and some of them are just individual, they're just for that one individual person that he can bring on his own. That's what this parsha deals with. And if you truly understand the concept of what a korban is, listen, I don't think anybody really does, it's a tremendous idea that it goes throughout all of Klal Yisrael. I'm going to give you a tiny little bit. If you don't fully understand it, it's because you don't know Kabbalah. If I didn't fully explain it, it's because I don't know Kabbalah either. So we have a double whammy going for us over here, but it's a Kedushas Levi. So if a Levi Yitzchak Mibreditcher says it, we can probably get something out of it. Understand, when you want to do something bad, when we do something bad, the way for us to get a Kabbalah is by sacrificing an animal. What's the shot in sacrificing an animal? Says the Kedushas Levi. We all know the real atonement that anybody can get is Vidui and Tzvivui. You daven, you do tshuva, you do Vidui, and that all of a sudden is good for everybody. Since our sins do not affect God in the least, nothing can happen. But clearly the sacrifice of an animal means something, and clearly there's something we're trying to do by bringing it up to a Kadosh Baruch. Here's the deal. When a person sins, he destroys the entire world. The perfect example for that would be the Mavel. When the people started sinning and started sleeping with everything that was alive, the animals started sinning and started sleeping with everything alive. Then it sits as an unbelievable shot that all the dinosaurs were formed from different types of huge reptiles getting together with different types of big animals. Now, I know this sounds strange to people that know science today. The science today is probably not like the science before the Mavel. That would make the most sense. But these huge creatures that look like half bird, half reptile creatures, or even like huge oak-like creatures, because I'd imagine there is an Ibn Ezra that says that oak had really, really small arms and massive, massive legs, which would make him like a real big Tyrannosaurus Rex. Those types of guys would be from some sort of interbreeding from one animal to another that was able to happen in the beginning of the world up until the year 1656 when the Mabel happened. That was the concept of what it was. So the Mabel, everything was affected. Noah was metakin the entire world by going in the Teva, starting over the entire world, and making everything a little bit different afterward. And from that point on, they were able to eat meat. What does that mean? You're able to eat meat. Why all of a sudden are you able to eat meat because you were metakin the world? The answer is that all the animals belong to man. If man does good, then there's good things happen with the animals. If man does bad, then bad things happen to the animals. It's not surprising that the first, I guess you can say, study of non-straight creatures was in San Francisco. Then all of a sudden they found male birds that were roosting with one another. It makes sense. If the people are sinning that way, then they're going to affect all the animals that are around them. If the people aren't sinning, then obviously the animals are not going to be affected. It's the obvious idea of what you're supposed to do over here. What that means is the following. When we sin, we bring a korban. Because our sins destroy the animals of the world. Which means we take that animal and we try to be malit. How are we malit? We do tshuva, we do vidui, we dive into a Kadosh Baruch Hu, we ask a Kadosh Baruch Hu for mercy. And by doing so, by getting ourselves involved in that, what we're doing is we're raising up all the animals and everything in the world to a higher level. The remez to that is putting the animal on top of the mizbeach and burning it up and letting it go up to Shemayim. You see the animal going up. Your level is being raised, and thus you're raising other animals in the world. That's the concept. Why we bring korbanos of animals? To show that we're raising everything to the next level. Okay, not so bad, right? When you understood Kabbalah, it was very clear. But if we don't, then it's just a rib lady, you're fine. There are 9 times we mention the B'nai Aaron in this parsha, instead of mentioning Aaron directly. Aaron is not mentioned directly the entire way through Vayikra. It keeps saying B'nai Aaron, B'nai Aaron, B'nai Aaron. 9 times, says the Medrash. It's because 9 times his name was mentioned by the Egel Azov. 9 times Aaron is mentioned by the Egel Azov, so his name was taken out 9 times in this parsha. The first time he appears is by the Trumas Hadeshen. In the beginning of Parsha Tzav, where you take out the ashes from on top of the Mizbeach, that's the first time Aaron is mentioned in all Sefer Vayikra. Says the Chasam Sofer, it can't be it's Liganai. It can't be we're taking down Aaron for the Egel Azov and we're taking him out, because here we're learning all the greatest things that happen to all the Kohanim. It can't be that that's the pshat. So we have to go back to Purim. Okay, let's go back to Purim for a second. We know that Mordechai, after the Purim story was over, was brought down. What was the wording of the pasuk? Anybody remember? He ratzui l'rovechav. He was happy, and everybody was happy with him. L'rovechav. Many of his brothers were happy with him, but not Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin was not happy with him at all. Why? Because he didn't learn enough Torah. Can you imagine? The guy just saved all the Klal Yisrael, but he didn't learn enough Torah. And because he had stopped learning Torah, and he was being matzo nefashos and going saving people, they looked down at him and said, that's not a chosh of a guy. Now try to understand something, guys. We all know pikuach nefesh is doka toro. If you're sitting in the base medrash and you're dying, should you go to the hospital? Yeah, it's a good idea to go out there. Obviously, pikuach nefesh is going to be doka any talmud Torah that a person has. So I don't get it. If pikuach nefesh is doka Torah, if Atzalos nefesh is doka Torah, and Mordechai was into Atzalos nefeshos, then you expect Mordechai to leave the base medrash to go save all of Klal Yisrael. So I don't understand. How could you get angry at him? How could the Sanhedrin separate from him for not learning Torah if that's what he was doing? The answer is, sometimes when these situations come into your hands, it's for a reason. Chazal looked at it and said, you know, any one of us could have saved all of Klal Yisrael. Let's be honest for a second over here. What would have happened is that if Mordechai wouldn't have saved Klal Yisrael, Daniel would have saved Klal Yisrael. If Daniel wouldn't have saved Klal Yisrael, Ezra would have saved Klal Yisrael. If Ezra wouldn't, Nehemiah would have. Chag Ezekiah Malachi would have. Hanani Mishael Bazariah would have. Shimon HaTzadik would have. Yirmiah wasn't alive. Well, Baruch Ben Neriah was still alive. He would have. Somebody would have saved Klal Yisrael if not for Mordechai. So why was Mordechai the person? So Sanhedrin looked at it. The Bnei Yisrael looked at it and said, oh, Mordechai is the most cautious. So he's the one that's doing it. Sanhedrin looked at it and said, because his learning is the least desired by God. God didn't care about his learning. So he was given the opportunity to save Klal Yisrael and not us. Because somebody whose learning is so desired by God, he would let him stay in the base medrash the whole time, and he wouldn't let him go anywhere else. He must not be Makshav his Torah. If he's not Makshav his Torah, then don't let him be there. Kohanim were made to serve in the Beis HaMikdash. They don't have a choice. But the problem is, if they really know how to learn, they should be sitting in the Beis Medrash the whole time. They shouldn't be serving in the Beis HaMikdash, even if there's a mitzvah to go serve in the Beis HaMikdash. Let someone else do it while they go sit in the Beis Medrash the whole time. If their learning is so important, they should be doing that over anything else. There should be nothing else there. Hashem should have never given them that opportunity to serve in the Beis HaMikdash. So by Aaron, Aaron's Torah learning was so great and so strong, as we learned 3 weeks ago, the Rabim Heshiv Me'avon, his Torah learning was able to affect all of Klal Yisrael and give peace and everything to all of Klal Yisrael. Aaron belonged in the Beis Medrash. He did not belong in the Beis HaMikdash serving. So he wasn't brought there unless he needed to be there. His sons took over all the Avodah. He only did what he absolutely needed to do, and he left as soon as he could to go run back to the Beis Medrash. That's who Aaron HaKohen was. He spent all of his time in the Beis Medrash, spent a little bit of time in the Beis HaMikdash. The times that he went to the Beis HaMikdash was in the early morning when he did the Trumas Hadashan. The Trumas Hadashan has a tremendous sod behind it. So we specifically mention Aaron's name by that. But to bring in Ola, Achatas, and Asham, Shlomim, anything that other people needed to bring, the other Kohanim can take care of that. The B'nai Aaron can take care of that. Everything that Aaron needed to do, he spent his time doing. He had to be there on Yom Kippur, he was there on Yom Kippur. He had to serve there early in the morning, he was there early in the morning. Everything else, he allowed everything else to be there, and that's the pshat of the Egel Azov. He was mentioned 9 times by the Egel Azov to show that he had risked his life and allowed himself to be there for Klal Yisrael, taught Bnei Yisrael how to stay away from Avodah Zarah. His teaching, his learning, his methodology worked, because at the end of the day, as we know, Moshe Rabbeinu came down and Bnei Yisrael was able to be saved. Had he not done that, who knows what would have happened to all of Klal Yisrael. That's the pshat that Aaron is mentioned over here, because his learning is so important, so unbelievably important. I'm going to end off with a little bit of a story. It goes like this. It says by a Nasi, that when a Nasi does a chet, Asher Nasi Yachata. It's weird, because by the other ones, it says, V'im called Atziso Yishku, if they do a sin. When he does a sin, but it's really sort of like an if he does a sin. Here it's Asher Nasi Yachata. That a Nasi will sin. Says the Kli Yakar, the greater you are, the more culpable, the more available you are for the sins that are there. Because when you have that type of gaiva, going back to what we were saying before, then it's more likely that you're going to be involved in those types of sins. There was a Talmud in Yeshiva, in Rabin, who was very angry that there were so many rich people who weren't donating their money properly. They weren't giving it to the right places, he felt, and he was extremely upset about it. So he went to the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim was never a Rosh Yeshiva or a Rav in the Yeshiva in Rabin, but he was obviously one of the most kosher people in the world who lived in Rabin, who hired other people to be the Rosh Yeshiva and the Rabbanim of the town, but he himself said he was just a stam boy, some person who wrote Sfarim. The Chafetz Chaim, he went to the Chafetz Chaim to get a bracha, so that he should become rich, and he would be able to donate correctly to the right causes. That's what he went to the Chafetz Chaim for. Chafetz Chaim did not answer him. He just shook his head. That's all he did. He refused to give him a bracha. The guy left, went out into business, and became very, very successful. He moved to St. Petersburg, which I guess was one of the major industry centers, one of the places where the main business was, and became one of the most affluent and influential Jews that was in there. And but, of course, he became a tremendous miser. Refused to give his money to anything, let alone to the right Jewish causes. He loved his money, and he kept saving it, and he probably gave excuses to himself. I would assume he said, well, I gotta wait until I have X amount of money, and then I'll be able to give Meiser. Like, I can't give Meiser now, because I don't really have it liquidated, so I'll just give Meiser when I get that money. And then eventually the money came, and he said, well, now I need it for that business deal, I'll give it the next time. I would assume, to be Ben Lechov's close to somebody who possibly existed, I would say that it makes a lot of sense that he had good intentions in mind, just never came out to see it. Eventually, the Chofetz Chaim came to St. Petersburg. For whatever reason, he was around there, and this Talmud came out to greet him. The Talmud brought him over to his house, sat him down, gave him that plush big chair, sat him down and gave him a good meal, gave all of his servants were around, and the man boasted of all his riches and told the Chofetz Chaim, didn't I tell you that if I went out into business, I would be successful? Look at what I've done. So Chofetz Chaim, in his soft demeanor, went up to him and said, so what's with tzedakah? How much do you give to tzedakah? The man didn't know what to say. He was embarrassed. So he didn't answer the Chofetz Chaim. Even more embarrassing, the Chofetz Chaim was silent right back. He didn't even give the mussar that you knew the Chofetz Chaim could give. He just sat there and he looked at the guy. So finally the guy looked up with the yeshiva shikah, and he turned over the Chofetz Chaim and he said, tell me, Rebbe, I don't understand. Is it that this was always in myself? I just tricked myself into thinking that I would be a tremendous person if I had a lot of money? Or is it that I changed? And as time went on, I'm just a different person. Back then, I really was telling the truth. I really wanted to give tzedakah, but now I'm a totally different person from what I was. Which one is it? He's told over a story. Man came to the diamond district. I kind of changed around because he was talking about like massive bales of corn. And I'm just like, yeah, that's not going to fit in 2013. So either way, so it's like this. Futures market, right? Because we're all there. A man came to the diamond district and was looking for the perfect engagement ring. Okay? He's a normal guy, walks in, and says, show me all your settings, all the different types of settings. So apparently girls didn't do it at this time. But either way, he looked ahead. Oh, he's a girly guy, that's fine. So they showed him like all these different settings and all these different ones. And he looks around and he sees one that's like extra big, way bigger than all the others. So he said, I want that one. I really want the one that has the biggest setting. They came to the diamonds. They started choosing out diamonds, and the guy started showing them, like, you know, the 1 carat diamonds, 1.5 carat diamonds, 2 carat diamonds. The guy looks at each one and he says, showing it in the setting, and they're like, it doesn't fit the setting, right? It just doesn't fit inside there, right? So he's like, let's make it a little bit bigger, a little bit bigger. And he's showing bigger and bigger diamonds until they saw he got to the biggest diamond that they had inside the entire store. And the diamond fit perfectly in the setting. You didn't need any other stones around it. It was an absolute perfect diamond that was absolutely huge. And the guy looked at it and said, this is exactly what I'm looking for. I am looking for this type of a diamond to fit on this type of a setting. This is absolutely perfect. So the diamond dealer was like, went down to the, cash register and said, okay, this is going to be quite a bit of money. Rung it all up and said, it's going to be $100,000. $100,000. The guy's like, what? I only have $5,000. I can't pay $100,000. The diamond dealer said, what's wrong with you? Why in the world, if you only have $5,000, were you picking the biggest setting and the biggest diamond? Don't you realize that that diamond's going to be a lot more than $5,000? So guys, look, it's your fault. When you saw me looking, you should have told me this is way out of my price range. This guy looks over at the diamond dealer and says, hold on a second. I'm the guy who's trying to make a money deal here. Okay? I realize that if the person wants something bigger, I'm going to want him to get something bigger. Of course I offered it to you because you never told me what your price range was. The bigger the diamond, the more you have to spend. That's just the way things go. And you should have taken that out and should have realized it yourself. Said the Chofetz Chaim that that's the idea. You think you're going to be the master of your wealth. But as the wealth gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and you get all into it, you don't realize that the more money you have, the bigger your Yetzer Hara gets. And although when you were small, when you had nothing, your Yitzhar wasn't there. It's because as you grow, as you have more, Yitzhar gets worse and worse and worse. So that it grows like the diamond. Till the end of the day, you come out with a $100,000 bill. You have no idea how you got there. When you really can only afford $5,000. So at the time, you changed. But it's a natural change. That's what happens when people go into the business. Unfortunately, there's no ending of the story of like, then he became the stifler. There's no story. Like, there's nothing like that. All we know about that guy is that the guy got a good lesson. It's a huge lesson for ourselves. Don't put yourself in the position of other people until you really you realize what goes into that type of an idea. You can't assume that everything's just going to be okay, because it never is. Anytime you put something into it, it's going to get worse and worse and worse. And I don't mean to say it in a worse way. I mean in a Yitzhara type of way, where it's just going to get harder and harder and harder. If you work on it now, little by little, then as you get bigger, it becomes a little bit better. But it never fully goes away. You can never assume that everything's just going to be easy. If only I was in that position. If you would be able to be successful in that position, you'd be in it already. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wouldn't have held you back. Since you're not, it's obvious and clear that you're not ready for that test just yet. And when you're ready, you'll have it, and it'll all be good. Have a good Shabbos, guys. That is that.
I have a question.